Maybe I need a stool. I'll tell you. Well, everyone, I'm Chris, and I'm an alcoholic.
Yes.
I've been praying about what the heck I'm supposed to share today, so y'all are going to have to blame God if it comes out wrong. The particulars, my sobriety date is January 18th, 2011. I have a sponsor, and I sponsor others, and I have a home group. We meet Saturday morning. A lot of you attend that, 7 a.m. at Reformation Lutheran Church in Culpeper. It's a big book study, and if you ask my sponsor, I say it's the best meeting in town. And I think most of us, if your home group's not the best meeting in town, then probably find another one. One thing I will say I enjoy about that meeting is, you know, we are currently on To the Wives and dying to get through it. But, you know, we stop at each paragraph practically and have a damn good meeting. Oops, excuse me. Darn good meeting. It's just amazing how a few words can bring up, not necessarily on topic, but what needs to be shared that day. Usually I go through this chronologically. It's the only way I've known how to do it. You know, I'm supposed to tell you what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. You know, to tell you the truth, I always feel that I'm just a garden variety drunk. I mean, I didn't have a lot of consequences. I had a good life, a good upbringing. I just found that alcohol was something that worked for me. You know, for the most part, I can tell you, like, as a kid, you know, up until about third, fourth grade, I think I was normal. You know, I think I was free and didn't really have a care and didn't think what other people thought of me. But about going through puberty time, you know, it was about the time I started going, hey, everybody else knows something I don't know. And I just felt out of place. I was always, what are other people thinking about me? Or am I doing this right? Am I doing that right? Heck, tonight still, I'm like, did I do my tie right? Did I, you know, these clothes are too big? Or, you know, all that's still there. And, you know, really, I don't want to focus a whole lot on my drinking other than, you know, at 14, just about everybody's like, well, your first drink. And one other thing I'll point out is I listen to a lot of speakers, and nothing that I really say is going to be original, but it's how I relate from those speakers. And I regurgitate what they say because that's how I related. And there's one speaker, you know, everybody pipes up when you say, when's your first drink? And he brought up, he goes, does anybody remember when it was their first taco? You know, and I don't remember my first taco, you know, but my first drunk, I remember, you know, I was about 14 years old. Always had a lot of older kids in the neighborhood, so we didn't really have trouble getting alcohol. And a few of us arranged it for a, you know, a spend the night type of thing. I was, one of the things that kept me from drinking was I did have a good fear of my folks. I didn't want to come in drunk, but all was arranged. And they were like, we want to see Chris get drunk tonight. And I was like, okay, I can't. And I tell you, it was like the world changed that night. When I was drunk, I was free. I didn't care what anybody said. I was the life of the party. You know, I used alcohol after that all through high school. I wouldn't say I was drinking every day, but Martin, if I had the opportunity to get drunk, I got drunk. I went to a lot of parties. And believe it or not, I was the 112-pound wrestler on the wrestling team. And you know, one thing, as time goes by in sobriety, you start looking back and you start seeing these decisions you made in life. You know, at the time I would have never told you it was for alcohol, but I was a pretty good soccer player and a pretty good wrestler. But you know, I was 112 my sophomore year. I wanted to stick to it. The coach and the parents said, no, you can't, you got to go up a class. And I said, well, screw you all. You know, I'm not gonna. I still hung out with the wrestling team because they were cool and they were actually my bodyguards because drunk me would go out and stir up trouble and, you know, I'd get in behind them when somebody came after me. But, you know, it's just recently that I'm sitting there going, you know, I made that decision because I like to drink, you know, and over by my senior year, I was 150 pounds, you know, and I'm a short 4'11 at the time, you know, all of that was from alcohol, but didn't really occur to me. Going through, I had a lot of fear, you know, I was talking about not people, people not necessarily thinking what other people thought, but, you know, I had opportunities to go to college. I had decent enough grades, but I didn't want to leave home. You know, I was comfortable at home. I ended up going to community college. And I actually had a steady girlfriend during that time. So my drinking wasn't near that bad. But that ended and all my friends came back from college. And then it was the bar scene all the time. Or it was the party scene. And, you know, I always had trouble, fear of women, couldn't approach women. I swear, I didn't start any relationship if I wasn't drunk. And I stayed in a lot of relationships. Here's another one from a speaker, you know, rather than have a one night stand, I think it's much better to drag it out for 3 years rather than just tell them, you know, that this isn't working. And that was me, you know. I would get stuck in this thing of a drunken evening and go, I can't say it was that. Next thing you know, I'm dating somebody for 2 years. But that's alcohol worked for me in that sense. I would go out to bars, go out with women, you know, because I was drinking. The early on, again, when it's working, it was that drinking to meet them. Drinking was always involved at some point, but there were times where I could be sober and still function and be around them. Over time, though, it just progressed more and more. I moved in with a buddy of mine. And one of the things that really affected me early on was, it was 1997. I guess I'm just before 30, late 20s. And we did a lot of garage drinking and a lot of drinking at the house, but it was February, Daytona 500. I was drinking all day because I used to be a huge NASCAR fan. Then the race was over around 5. Well, I got a phone call from one of my girlfriends and said, "Hey, you want me to cook you dinner?" Now, I lived in Noakesville. She lived in Centerville. And of course, I thought nothing of it. I didn't think I was, you know, I could drive. Well, I threw in a 12-pack in the back of the truck because I knew she wouldn't have enough up there for me. Hopped in, thought I was Dale Earnhardt, and flipped my truck. Luckily, it ended up teetering. The hood was on the top of the bank, and the back of the car was on the roadway, and I was in the rain ditch. So it didn't crush it. You know, when that car got flipped over and everything, and I looked at it, I didn't have a seatbelt on. One of the hardest things to do was to find the door handle when you're upside down. I was coherent enough, though, to find that door handle, find that 12-pack, and throw it in the bushes. Unfortunately, the person that lived there saw me throw it in the bushes and pulled the top. And, you know, I spent the night in jail. That's my only night in jail. And it, you know, it's one of those deals where it sobers you up for a little bit. You know, I made it about a week. You know, even my roommate's like, "Not drinking tonight, are you?" And I'm like, "No." But, you know, time went on. And I was like, what that did to, I didn't end up with a DUI. There's the other thing. I ended up getting off on some technicality. They were supposed to allow breathalyzer. They didn't have a breathalyzer on hand because it was a holiday weekend. And my lawyer was trying to set precedent. I was like, woohoo, you know, so I didn't get a DUI. But over time, I started drinking more, you know, it just progressed. One of the things I learned with that roommate was the whole, you know, a little bit of the hair of the dog that bit you. You know, I'd wake up with these hangovers and it was like, well, you know, let me just crack beer this morning. And early on, it was, yeah, just that one beer got the hangover over. But, you know, over time, that hangover started to become, well, I need to get a little bit more and a little bit more. I eventually moved out of his house and bought my own house. You know, for me, life was going good. I didn't have consequences. I mean, I was getting promotions. I was, you know, moving up. And to tell you the truth, I had bought that house in 2001, was with the company I was with for, I guess at that time, it would have been about 8 years. And then 4 years later, the owners decided to sell. And to me, they just ruined the whole damn, there's a resentment, right? Mm-hmm. That was my, one of my biggest resentments, even when I came in here, and I came in there probably 10 years after that. I would drink it. Why'd those bastards have to sell the company? They ruined my progression, you know, through my career. They ruined my life. You know, that's how my thinking pattern worked. But I ended up, you know, I moved, I was living by myself. I still live by myself today. But there was nothing for me to every night grab a 12-pack, come home, sit on the couch, drink the 12-pack, pass out, get up and do it again. At first, it wasn't really a big deal. I could get up. I could function. You know, now I just lost train of thought. Anyway, I could get up and I could function at first. But over time, what ended up happening is I'd wake up and, man, it'd take 20 minutes to get everything out of my body before I could stand up straight and get dressed. And, you know, Thurston, I'm glad you're here. You're always one that says, I got sick and tired of being sick and tired, you know. That was something I heard early on from Thurston, and it was something I could relate to, you know, because, and the other one was the merry-go-round of life. You know, what started happening was I would do that every day. The other funny one was I always used to think that, okay, I can drink. I wouldn't eat dinner when I came home. I had to drink. You don't eat because it affects the buzz. You know, I had to drink first and get the buzz. Otherwise, I would have to drink more. But at the end of the night, I always thought, oh, a big plate of pasta, I'll soak all that up. Hence, I blew up when, over time, and it never did work. But that became the merry-go-round. It's just, and I always relate to basically driving home and going, I'm not going to drink tonight. What really started happening was, okay, I'm not going to stop at this 7-Eleven, I'll stop at this 7-Eleven. And I had like three or four so that I went to different ones every night so they didn't know how much I was drinking. The funniest part about that was, and this was always embarrassing too, is on the weekends, you know, I'd be in Food Lion and I'd, you know, I did my grocery shopping over at Martin's, but I'd buy my beer at Food Lion. I don't know what theory that was, but I'd go to Food Lion on Sunday mornings and I'm slapping a case of beer on the turnstile there. And everybody else got eggs, milk, bread, you know, and sometimes I'd just buy something that looked, oh, this is for the party later, not now. And you really needed it at 7 in the morning, did you? But one week I had actually, bought my beer at Food Lion, but I had forgotten to buy my chewing tobacco. And I went into the little local mart that I always go into. That was one of the marts I always stopped at. And I bought my chew, and the guy behind the counter was like, oh, great, you quit drinking. And I was like, no, I just got that earlier. You know? But that wasn't a trigger that, you know, somebody totally not involved in my life said something to me about, hey, you're drinking a little too much. Really what ended up, you know, I ended up eventually going, I've got to do something. I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. I was tired of waking up every morning. I was tired of going into work and having cheery people walk up to me. You know, how do these people have so much energy first thing in the morning? I was tired of sitting there with a hangover until 2 and going, okay, I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to drink. And, you know, and right about 2 is when it eases a little bit. And then it's still, I'm not going to drink, but I do. The other one I never could understand was when I did buy, you know, when I said I was only going to have 1 or 2, I never could have 1 or 2. I would reach in that. The other part that I never understood was, if I want one or two, why am I not buying a six pack? Why am I buying a 12 pack or a case? But it would always be at the end of the night. It was like, how did I drink that much? I didn't mean to. But I got tired of that. I was seeing a girl at the time, and I actually fessed up enough to her that I needed to do something about my drinking. It's just getting too bad. But I wasn't going to go to AA. I had previous knowledge of AA because the street I grew up on had two alcoholics on it. And I actually saw, I was the paper boy. So I would have to go to their house to deliver. Usually didn't see them when you delivered, but when I collected, I would have to go. And I can tell you, I walked up, knocked on the door, and the one woman was slurring and, had her drink in her hand. The other gentleman was my one buddy's father. And, every time I went to his house, he had 55-gallon drum liners, four or five in a week, filled with beer cans. So, and he was an angry drunk. But both of those people made it to AA. And both of those people I got to see sober. In fact, the gentleman, I didn't realize it at the time, but none of the other neighbors just bought small Christmas presents for me. But he would always purchase me a log of, I've been chewing forever. It's one thing I haven't gotten over. But buy me a log of chew at Christmas. Well, another part of that story was I used to play in their sandbox, and in his one of angry things, all my Tonka toys were over there. He got angry, loaded up all our Tonka toys and took them to the dump. And I learned in here that basically what that man was doing was paying me in amends. Now, he didn't actually talk to me about it, but he was giving back. Now, knowing those two, I knew that AA was where you go to never drink again. I am not going in there. I just want to learn how to drink. I want to learn how to control. And so my route was to go to a counselor. And I ended up at a counselor. And, at first she listened to me the first week, and it was nothing real, no lightning bolts or anything of that nature. Second, pretty same. By the third week, she said, "You sound like an alcoholic. You should go to AA." And I didn't want to hear that. I really didn't want to hear that. And truthfully, I really did not want to quit drinking. I wanted to control my drinking. I was telling her about, she was the one that was on the, use your willpower to avoid going to 7-Eleven. I'm like, it don't work. It just doesn't work. But she gave me a meeting guide. Now it was in Warrenton. But I'm in IT, and I know the internet, know how to use the internet, and I found meetings in our area. And funny thing was, my first meeting was supposed to be Monday. But we all know how we are on Mondays. Yeah, because I had a rough weekend, and I needed a little bit more to get over that rough weekend. And one thing that I was telling myself is, I can't walk into an AA meeting drunk. I know a little bit better now, but I wasn't going to do that. And so I ended up ended up at the Tuesday evening going out to Church on the Rise on 522. A lot of people are aware of that one. And I tell you, I grew up in Northern Virginia. I guess I'd been here about 8 years when I, 8 to 10 years when I, and all I did was go from my house to Northern Virginia to work and back and maybe do a few stores. I did not participate in Culpeper life at all. And I drove out to that church, and it was dark, and it was a gravel pad, and there's hardly any. I've always been early for everything I go to. And I sat in the parking lot, watched a few people, and like, I don't know if I want to go into this darn thing. And of course, then I go in there and I sit down, and I thought I was sitting at the back, but I ended up being at the front. The other thing I didn't realize is how well a newcomer sticks out like a sore thumb, and that night I did not pick up a 24-hour chip. But they did what a lot of us do. And they have a, you know, step 1 through 3 meeting that night. And, you know, these people were sharing about stuff that I wouldn't tell anybody. You know, yeah, I don't admit my fears. You know, I never wanted to admit that I had trouble asking a woman to dance, or, you know, fear of all sorts of fears that are in my head, fear of getting fired, fear of, I just always had fears. My life ran on fear. But they shared a lot, and that was enough for me to get interested. I think I saw my counselor in between, and I said, yeah, I'll probably try another one. The next meeting I went to was at the hospital on Thursday night. They used to have the new birth meeting there. And it wasn't so much, I don't really remember much about that meeting. I do believe I picked up, that's where I picked up my 24-hour chip. But the one thing I do remember about that night is Steve A handed me a CD. It wasn't the full set, but it was Joe and Charlie talking about the doctor's opinion. And, you know, I think Steve only had like 4 months at that time. You know, so in saying that, you never know when you're going to help somebody else. You know, if you got a day longer than the next person, you could probably help them. But he handed me that, and I had my long drive back and forth to work. And the next morning, I threw that CD in, and when they described the allergy of alcoholism, the whole craving part of it. I'm a logical person. I definitely wasn't spiritual when I got here. And I also, you know, I needed proof or facts. And from the way they described that, in the sense that once I put one in, I craved more and I craved more and I craved more. That was the logic I needed to go, okay, now I can accept that I'm an alcoholic. Because that's true, you know. And then even in the book, it's, you know, if you can't control it once you start, or if you can't stay stopped, you know, those were two things that I could relate to. Those are the things that work for me as far as I'm an alcoholic. Now, my brain, I tell you, will like to convince me I'm not. To this day, a lot of times it'll convince me I'm not. But I can always go back to that. Into those two sentences and go, nope, you're an alcoholic. But once I got into that meeting, you know, and got that, you know, I started using the internet and I was downloading speakers left and right, and found the whole Joe and Charlie series. And, you know, I was always a morning person because I was getting up at 4:30 to go to work anyway. So this Saturday 7 a.m. meeting didn't seem like an issue at all for me. And I went there, and of course, we used to be over at the Baptist church. Well, not in the church, but in the house across the street. But I parked in the parking lot of the church. And of course, my friend here, Monique, I'd always wait for her to drive down. And the funny thing is, you know, I prejudge people. You know, I always do. And I watch and I go, oh, there goes that little lady. What's she doing here? She, you know. I had my little comments on everybody walking through. Now, of course, most of you know Monique and I are tight friends now. But that meeting is where I met my sponsor. Now, not right away, because like I told you, I had downloaded Joe and Charlie. I had downloaded speakers. I had a book. I was going to do this on my own. But every Saturday, that man wouldn't let me get out the door if I tried. And he kept saying, don't try and do this on your own. And then all those speakers I was listening to said, get a sponsor, get a sponsor. Like, well, if I want to do it right, I'm going to get a sponsor. And I ended up getting a sponsor, you know, and Rich D's my sponsor. And, you know, he took me through the steps. I always love, you know, hearing others talk about, we're doing Joe and Charlie on Friday night now at the Methodist Church. And, you know, they're sort of the page by page, read the foreword. You know, I never read a book from the foreword. You start at chapter one, you know. But no, what I got was open the page, you know, the first page. What's it say on that? That's how much you know about alcoholism. That's what I got. You know, it's blank. You know nothing. And he's right. You know, I did know nothing. The other one he put in my head is, it's our basic text. Look up those words. You know, it's a textbook. You're supposed to study it. You don't just read it like a novel once. And that's why I sort of love that meeting we have on Saturday, because we study the big. It takes us, last time I think was 7 months, but we've got a bigger crowd now. And I think we're going over a year to get through 164 pages. But Rich took me through the steps. And, you know, step one, I've already described the allergy thing had me triggered. As far as the insanity, gosh, you know, I'm not insane. I got a job, I got a car, house, you know, I got all this stuff. What makes you think I'm insane? And it just took a little bit to understand, you know, one is, you know, doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. Well, that I could accept for the drinking. But where I came to my understanding and my conclusion was, I was insane in the sense that how I handled life emotionally. You know, alcohol was my solution to any problem I had. Get drunk to enjoy it, get drunk to drown it, you know, get drunk to get through it. That's how I handled anything that happened. And, you know, I had the emotions of, and I always relate to this too, you know, you stopped maturing at the time you started your first drink. You know, and you know, I'm a 14-year-old and I'm 40 years old. You know, I still say I'm still growing up. I haven't gotten too far. But that's how I accepted that, the emotions. You know, I just didn't handle life right. My answer to everything was take a drink when you have a problem. God was a sort of an issue. It wasn't that I didn't believe in God, you know. It was just God was punishing. That's what I felt. I grew up Catholic. There were a lot of things in the Catholic Church that I just didn't understand. It's sort of like, why do you give us urges and then don't allow us to use them? Those sort of things that bugged me. So I had another speaker that described, you know, you get the sexual urge and you're not supposed to use it. Well, it's like filling up the dog bowl with food, letting him eat it, and then hitting him over the head with a baseball bat. You know, that's something I related to, because any time that I did, I felt like afterwards I was punished. You know, I should be punished. So the God I grew up with wasn't the God that I can relate to. And that's, I love that it says a God of your understanding. You know, it's not the God of the church. And the other thing I relate to other people saying is, you know, religion is one thing, spirituality is another. And I eventually came to an understanding with my higher power, especially when I actually had, I wouldn't call it Bill's flash of light, but I had a spiritual experience. It's one of those other people, you can't describe it. It's just something that happens, you know, because after that very first meeting, I went home, crawled up in bed, fetal position, crying, and just said, God, I hope this works. Please help me. And I had a feeling come over me like it's going to work. You know, it just, it's hard to describe. But, you know, once I formed my relationship with my higher power, going through the rest of the steps, I had a lot of trust. The fourth step was wonderful in getting over, you know, I told you about the resentment with the bosses that owned my company. That was something that I drank over and over again. And then there's other resentments, anger, you know, and really the biggest thing for me is fear. Realizing how much my life is driven by fear. One of the other descriptions I've heard of fear is a speaker is talking about how, so when you fire a gun, the bullet comes out at 400 feet per second. But if you fire it in water, it comes out 400 feet per second, goes into the water, goes about 2 feet, and plops. And he described it, the water is my fear. You know, I have all this gumption to get up and do these things I'm scared of, but then it's like a fear hits me in the face and I stop. I won't get past it. What I've learned in here, though, is if I say the right prayers and walk through that fear, most of the time, it's little stupid things that most people, well, here's what I say. It's little stupid things that I like to say I'm unique because I'm the only one that has that fear. But when I get into an AA meeting, I learn other people have that fear. You know, somebody else can help me get through that fear. But I went through all those. I went through my fifth step. You know, I sat down and, you know, I had a very good feeling after the fifth step. And I'll say to anybody that the best thing to do is to do a fourth and fifth. And it's never going to be perfect the first time you do it. I'm 12 years sober and still working on fourth and fifth stuff because, you know, we get to 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, you know, a lot, say maintenance steps. But because tell you, the first time I did 6 and 7, I thought I was going to be struck wonderful. I went home after the fifth. I didn't have a shelf or put my book on the mantle. I sat quietly for an hour, said those prayers and thought I was done. You know, I thought my defects were over with. That, you know, he's going to take. Now, I will tell you that that seventh step always leaves me an out. You know, the please take away my defects that are not are useful. I'm sorry, I'm losing it. But there's the part that's like are useful. And I'm like, huh, he's letting me do this still because it's useful to him. Yeah. I didn't have a lot of amends. You know, most of my amends, I hate to say I'm thankful for are the living amends, because most of my issues were absenteeism. You know, I'd say I was going to be someplace and I overshot the mark. I can't, you know, and sometimes I call, sometimes I wouldn't call, or, you know, it's just mostly absenteeism. I didn't have any financial amends. But today, you know, those living amends have been just being present for other people. The one thing I heard early on was, you know, be where you say you're going to be, do what you say you're going to do. And, you know, so when I make a commitment, I show up. You know, Dale asked me to do this. At first, I did have an honest thing that I was like, hey, can I get back with you? I should be able to do it. And I did check that, and it's like, damn, I can do it, you know. But so, you know, I said I'd be here. I'm here, you know, and that's what AA has taught me. And it's not just in AA. You know, practice these principles in all our affairs. The one thing AA is helping me do today is to try and be a better person everywhere, not just in these rooms. You know, so I've gone through the steps numerous times, and the later ones, you know, what my sponsor's done, well, you're going to lead this one, you know, and we're doing group step studies. And, you know, doing the steps with other people, and what we have some worksheets we work out that ask questions and that sort of thing. And then, you know, next week, come back with what you think from that. And I tell you, working with other people on that sort of structured thing, you see things from a lot of different angles. You know, that's the one thing that I love about AA is I've met people I would have never met before. You know, I have friends in different, you know, different vocations and different ways of life and everything else that I wouldn't have met before. And it's just amazing how, dang, I wouldn't have seen it from that angle if I wasn't here. You know, it's always somebody else's perspective that helps me, because I'm in tunnel vision. This is me. And, you know, my alcoholic brain wants to convince me that I'm doing it right. And I need my sponsor, my other AA friends to go, hey, yeah, if you looked at it this way, or just sitting in a meeting, you know, a lot of times, I, you know, I'm not sharing in a meeting because I'm taking in so much. You know, it's just amazing how much others share that gives me a new perspective. Will say that today through sobriety, I've gone through numerous things. One that always sticks out to me is, before I got here in 2007, I was laid off from work. And, you know, I did the bare minimum trying to get my next job. You know, and I will say that company gave me a pretty good severance, so it didn't make it too urgent. But it was for unemployment checks, get online, file 3 resumes. All right, now you can go get your drinks and start drinking the rest of the day. And that, you know, when I was laid off at that point, it was trying to get ready for an interview when I did get one, you know, after a hangover, it wasn't real fun. I experienced the same thing. And I guess 2000 during COVID, 2020, I got laid off several times. That time, I was so much more at peace. You know, I was along the lines of, you know, well, I'm apparently not supposed to keep this job. You know, something will come up. Now, I've been driving from Culpeper to Northern Virginia forever. I ended up, you know, and the other thing was, is I'd get up and I'd do my resumes and all that. But then, hey, I'm out in the yard. I built a few retaining walls. I was active. I was going to AA meetings. I wasn't sitting on my ass. I wasn't sitting on my butt drinking beer all day and passing out. I was actually active. And I could help. I mean, I was available. Somebody in AA needed to move. I was like, okay, I can help you. You know, volunteer my time to help somebody else. Like I said, I was working in Northern Virginia all those years. Well, I ended up applying for a job down in Orange and a job up in Fauquier. And darn it, both of the offers didn't come in at the same time. Now, that bugged me because now I got to prey on which darn one do I take. Luckily, my parents' neighbor actually worked for the one in Fauquier and gave me some inside scoop. And I was like, well, that doesn't sound too good. And I took the job in Orange. Now I've gone from having an hour and a half commute every day one way to a 20-minute commute. And instead of, you know, getting angry at people on 66, all I do is, you know, sit behind tractors hauling hay, you know. and the sad part, being a good alcoholic, I do get upset at darn tractor. And then 5 seconds later, I go, but you're not sitting on 66. You know, look for the good in it. Look for the good in the situation. Another thing that I started early on is a gratitude list. You know, that started early. And that actually helps me both in being grateful and looking for the good in my day, but also doing my step 10. Because as I'm looking for my gratitude, I can also go, where have I been angry? Where have I been fearful? You know, and I'm going to look for those things. And I see them both. And, you know, I don't know. I've always had this thought that everything has to be so formal. You know, I've come to find it isn't. It doesn't have to be that formal, at least not for me. I did take a point where I started doing my 10-step not on paper, but on my, I'm a computer guy. I did it on the computer. I was doing it daily. And I realized, man, I'm having the same problem every single day. And of course, it was the same person every single day. I will say the angry man's prayer is something that I use regularly. I can tell you that within my first year of sobriety, I worked as a government contractor and I had a government employee sit no further than Billy is for me. And it was open cubes. And that guy's statement to me, I'm the government, and you'll do it. You know, and that just tore me. But they taught me, you know, pray for that guy. Pray for him to have everything that you want. And I started doing it, you know. And eventually, I wouldn't say he was my best friend, but we were cordial. We could get along. He no longer went with that attitude towards me. It's like everything just sort of cleared up in that sense. And I'm trying to do it now. Well, I have a new one, but it isn't quite the same anger and it, you know, irritation. It's a little different. And I'm trying to do it, and it is improving, I will say. But like I said, I was doing it nightly on paper. And I was like, we know that. That's quick. But the gratitude list has always been. The other thing is I'm accountable. I send that gratitude list out. I'm accountable to all the people that I send it to. I'm accountable to my sponsor. People know where I'm at, when I'm going to miss. You know, I started when we had COVID, I started going to our meeting early because I was running the Zoom part of it. Somehow or another, I still get to that meeting 45 to a half hour early. And it's not that I don't trust our coffee makers, but it's just that I do more of my visiting pre-meeting than post-meeting. You know, I always sit in there, and it's nice to greet. I'll never forget early on, service has been a big part of my sobriety. They touted me with coffee at the hospital meeting, and they had the old percolator pot. So you had to be there 45 to a half hour early. And I'll tell you, I didn't drink coffee, so I didn't know how to make coffee. And you know, somebody said, well, you know, there's instructions on the can, you know, and oh, that worked. I made coffee. But what that did get me is I'm one of my big things is I'm not open. I'm a person that likes to be a recluse and I don't reach out. But when you're sitting in that room by yourself and somebody new or out of town walks in early, well, they're going to talk to you and you got to talk back. So, you know, I started being able to greet other people, you know, service in general. I've always felt that, you know, being the high bottom drunk, I'm not the best sponsor in the world. I don't have a lot of experience with some of the stuff that others may have gone through. So I've stayed more on the business side of things. I've been out of it for a little while, but I've been, you know, I'm treasurer at my home group. But, you know, I was treasurer for the district. I was secretary for the district. I represented the intergroup at the district. And, you know, I enjoyed all those positions. It is nice to know the, I don't know if you want to call it business side of AA, but the AA structure, the pyramid, how it all works. I suggest others go to these like delegate shares and, you know, hear what's going on from the top down. I'm a traditionalist. I like the book the way it was or the way it is, you know, from how it was written when it was written. And, you know, being involved in that and knowing what's coming up, you know, I can voice my opinion through my group conscience and, you know, have our group discuss it. You know, it is important, I think, to keep AA alive for the next one that walks through the door. Most, I don't know, I'm starting to run out of wind early today. I will say, you know, one thing that I have to keep in mind is keep coming to meetings. For me, I have to keep the meetings up. I've, especially at my length of sobriety, I've heard a lot of speakers talk about a lot of people that have had good lengths of sobriety and gone back out and, you know, some didn't make it back one way or another. And for me, I can see how, you know, when my brain wants to convince me that, oh, I don't need to go to that meeting tonight, my sobriety's good, you know, but I can see for me that building up over time. What the meetings helped me do is keep everything fresh in my head. You know, when a situation arises, because I'm going to meetings, the quick stuff come, you know, the stuff comes quickly to the top of my mind. If I wasn't going to meetings, it wouldn't be there, because this is my ego always gets in the way when it comes to meetings, because I want to share the, you know, wisest thing out of everybody in the meeting. And the ego gets in the way when I want to do that. Or, you know, I'll share. And then, you know, a little later on, somebody will bring something up and I'll go, damn, I knew that. I should have known that. I wanted to share that. You know, but the upside of it is that I hear it. You know, I do hear it. And it, because there's a lot of things that were real fresh and stuck in my head at early sobriety. But then I haven't heard them in, you know, months, maybe a year even. And then somebody will bring it up. And I'm like, oh yeah, that was a good tool. You know, that was a good thing to keep, to fix this, help me with this situation or that situation. I can tell you, I've had ups and downs, hills and valleys, especially daily meditation and prayer. I'm not a meditator. I did early on try and sit. I'd go set the timer on the microwave, go over to a chair and be quiet and close my eyes, and all I did was peek over at the clock. You know, I couldn't sit quietly. I've come to realize that's not necessarily what I need to do. I just need to sit quietly, you know, and it doesn't have to be for the 5 minutes or whatever. But my prayer is constant. I mean, early on, somebody, hey, you know, view your higher power sitting in the car seat next to you, and you're just having a conversation. You know, and that's sort of how my day rolls. If I'm not involved in an activity or with coworkers or something like that, that's got my mind, but if I'm by myself, I'm like, oh, God, no, God, this, and God, that, and, you know, help me here. And all I've learned over time, and a lot I've shared, you know, the God before I got here, it was all Santa Claus, you know, butler, you know, you do this, you do that. And a lot of my problems were is when I demanded, you know, he didn't deliver and therefore he didn't care about me. You know, that was what the problem I had. Anymore, the prayers I've learned not to pray for myself unless it would help others. You know, that's something that's in our literature. But it's mainly, you know, help me do your will. Help me see your will. Help remove this fear. You know, help whoever get through this struggle they're getting through. Because another one, I always try to veer away from praying for outcomes. You know, he has a reason for that person to have cancer. I'm not the one to decide that they shouldn't. You know, all I can ask is that, you know, help them have strength and faith in you to get them through this situation. I've learned to do, I have a pretty decent sized family tree, and you know, where I was going with this is I've had ups and downs in that, where that has been good and that's been lull. I haven't been doing it. I moved from praying to reading at night before I went to sleep and saying something quick. I kind of lost my peace when I quit praying, like literally praying. And I got back into it, and you know, I used to have trouble sleeping because I had trouble sleeping before I got here. I used to pass out because I couldn't sleep. But you know, everybody I think is familiar with your mind. Just it's like your head hits the pillow and your mind turns on. It's not like it turns off. And I'm going through everything that needs to be done in the future. Or, you know, what happened in the past. But if I find myself praying for others, it's like all of a sudden, for me, praying is my meditation to sleep. I end up falling asleep while I'm praying. And getting back to that has also brought me a lot more peace during my day. You know, I thought, okay, I'll read a daily reflections or Asbel sees it at night, and I whipped through it and I didn't really think too much about what I read, and my days weren't going like that. But getting back into that contact, that, you know, I had the contact throughout the day, but those are the prayers that I think just bring me peace, bring me serenity, and keep that serenity. I really don't, like I said, I'm not a literary person. I'm a logic person, so I don't have a great thing to end on. I will say that, you know, AA has saved my life. I didn't get into a lot of the darkness of AA, but it saved my life. I was a miserable person. Many a drunk nights, all I wanted to do, I was always afraid the phone was going to ring and my parents were going to need me and I'd be too drunk or too passed out to be there for them. My dad just had surgery last week. And, you know, I was there to take him to this, because my mom won't drive anywhere but two lane roads in town. But I was there to get him to his surgery, get him through the surgery, help him out, and be there for them when they need stuff. Now, some of it's annoying. They're the type that I need help with my phone. I need help with my computer. And it is fun. They're getting to the point where they bicker and I get to play referee. But, you know, it's a joy. You know, at times I'll be irritated, but no, it's a joy to be available and be of service. It's a joy if I can be of service to anybody in here. I feel better when I see somebody recover. And not necessarily that I had anything to do with it, but if they were in the rooms, you know, when you first come in, you don't see that. When you're around here a while, you see the people that have, you know, come in the rooms and how bad off they are, you know, and then all of a sudden, my ex actually said, oh, I see it in your eyes. You know, it's like when we're drinking, there's a dead soul in the back of those eyes, but the light comes back. And, you know, I'm thankful to have that light back. Thanks for letting me share. Thank you. Yeah.